Quick message, John, just before we start, at 10 a.m. tomorrow, tickets for this year's Dalkey Book Festival go on sale. It's dalkeybookfestival.org. These tickets, as you know, sell out very
quickly.
Absolutely,
yeah.
We are kicking it off with a podcast, Johnny boy. Kicking it off with a podcast. But there's 70 events over 4 days in one small little town. We'll see you there. So tomorrow morning, 10 a.m., dalkeybookfestival.org.
You!
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It is time for the podcast, and we are going to conclude our mini-series on Turkey, the country of the future, the country that we believe is going to be one of the crucial countries over the course of the next 20 years. A place that's got enormous capacity. And John, a place where I was confused, as I told you, between Sophie Ellis-Bextor and the call to prayer.
Yeah.
And I chose Sophie. She didn't choose me, obviously, but I chose her.
You know, of course, that I worked in the Turkish section of BBC World Service.
Yeah, so you know these people.
Yeah, and I was in the Eurasia region. So it was all the Russians, the Turks, and everything east of there, all the way across to Afghanistan. But they were really different to everybody else, the Turks. They were brilliant crack, but they were serious guys. And you didn't mess around with them. You were on your game when you were working on the Turkish program.
And they'd buy and sell you. Yeah. They're really good commercially.
Absolutely. 5 o'clock in S11 in Bush House was the Turkish program. And it was brilliant.
John
it
was brilliant. Twiddling the knobs, doing his thing. Anyway.
I'll tell you one quick story.
Go.
They were doing a story on something about the Queen. And they had a clip of the Queen. Now, there is a rule in the BBC that, I don't know if it's a hard and fast rule, but you're not allowed pot cut the Queen. In other words, you're not allowed cut her off mid-sentence.
And
it makes sense, kind of. So we were in the middle of doing this program and I played the wrong clip. I played the clip of the Queen talking and I got this look dart through the window going, that's the wrong clip. And I went, oh, okay.
Oh, and you created the cardinal error of live on air.
Cut the Queen.
There he is. The blow for the Republic. That is it. Some Irishmen have fought for the Republic. Some Irishmen have laid down their lives for the Republic. And John Davis has interrupted the Queen for the Republic.
Cut her short.
So we are going to talk about another country that cut short their monarchy and cut short their sultanate and cut short their caliphate, and that is Turkey.
Oh, I see what you did
see
there,
what I mean?
Mike.
It's a country that's 100 years old, and 100 years ago, it did to the Ottomans what you did to the Queen in Bush House. You cut them off, right? But the reason I want to talk about it is that the history, economic history of Istanbul is so fascinating. So as we were saying there the other day, it was not only the home of one global empire, not only the home of two global empires, but three global empires.
Right.
So the Roman Empire in its last 100 years, the Byzantine Empire for 1,000 years, and the Ottoman Empire for 600 years.
Amazing. Yeah.
Now, and as I said to you before, the Ottoman Empire was so big that 50 states that constitute the United Nations today were in the Ottoman Empire.
That's a brilliant fact.
It's extraordinary, right?
That's a factoid for
That's
the pub.
That's a factoid, right? That's definitely one for
did
McKenna's.
You know?
I mean, up at McKenna's. Arthur, did you know, right? A word in your shell. So, but also, so much of our civilization. But what I want to do this podcast, John, is connect the Dublin Fusiliers.
Right.
With Waltzing Matilda.
Okay.
With Saint Cyril.
Yeah.
A man I know you think about a lot. Saint Cyril. With the Turks. With Orthodox Christianity, with Saint Brendan.
Right.
Just a little tour around, all the way up to Ataturk.
I think there were songs about all of these.
There are songs about all of these.
By the Dubliners.
Exactly, by the Dubliners, right? So the reason I'm sitting there, right, obviously for many, many Irish people, many of our great-grandparents and great-grandfathers fought in the Dardanelles, in the Gallipoli campaign, where 250,000 Allied troops were killed and 250,000 Turks. I mean, this is phenomenal, right? The Irish regiments in the Dardanelles were so decimated that the Dublin Fusiliers and the Munster Fusiliers had to be amalgamated to come up with one regiment because there's so many of them were killed.
Oh, right, right.
It's extraordinary. As I've always said, working class Dubliners weren't in the GPO. They were in the Somme and Gallipoli.
Yeah.
Real Dubliners, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's where the Dublin working class was. It was actually fighting for the Brits in the Dardanelles or in the Somme. It's an amazing story and we never, ever hear it. And nobody ever talks about it because everyone turned their backs on these guys. But that's where they were. So also, John, let's go back a bit, right? You have this Byzantine Empire. The Byzantine Empire created the most successful economy of the early Middle Ages. And the reason it did that was on the Silk Road.
Yes.
Between East-West Silk Road, so between Europe and Persia first, India, and of course, China. Mm. So the Marco Polo Silk Road, of course, at the epicenter was Istanbul, which was then Constantinople. So everything flowed through there. But there's also another interesting story. It wasn't just the East-West trade that flowed through Constantinople. North-South trade flowed from Russia, from the Vikings. So Kievskaya Rus, which is the original tribe of around Kiev, were a Viking tribe. And they traded with the Byzantines, right? And what do they trade? They trade slaves and furs. So fur and slaves. And of course, silk went up from the Byzantines. But one of the most fascinating discoveries, John, was Irish DNA. Irish DNA has been discovered by archaeologists in the Caspian and around the Black Sea.
Right.
Now, how did it get there? How did Irish people get there?
Yeah.
And we got there because Dublin was a slave trading outpost. So when the Vikings came to Ireland, they didn't come for amber or copper or gold. They came for people. That's what Ireland produced. And those people, mainly Irish women, were taken as slaves from Dublin. It's an amazing, up around Scotland.
Yeah.
In long ships.
Yeah.
Down the far side of Scotland, into around Norway and then into the Baltic at Denmark and through the Baltic. Imagine this, right? All the way over to what is now Estonia, Latvia, that part of the world. They were then marched across into the great rivers of Russia, the Dnieper and the Volga, which go all the way
down. Right.
That's how they were. So we were part of this trading empire.
Yeah.
Amazingly, unwillingly. And also, don't forget that this was the last outpost of Christianity. So the Byzantine Empire, so Rome had ceased to exist as a proper Christian area because it had to do all these deals with the Goths and the Visigoths and all these people, right?
Well, and Charlemagne as well. But had
all that sort of stuff, right? And then, but the Byzantines were the existential epicenter of Christianity. And what they did, fascinating, they started to actually, a fellow called Saint Cyril, who I know you're interested in, right?
Yeah.
Saint Cyril, right, started writing the Bible and giving this Bible to the Slavic people who the Vikings had put the Byzantines in contact with, right? Slavic traders.
Okay.
And that became Cyrillic, the alphabet of the Russians after Saint Cyril.
Okay.
And that was robbed from the Greeks because amazingly, the Byzantines spoke Greek. So the original Romans spoke Greek. And then, of course, you have this massive, big cleavage between the Orthodox religion, of the Constantinople Christians and the Roman...
The Great Schism, isn't
it? And the Roman Catholic, the Nicene Creed, John, right?
Right.
So you have all this stuff going on. Like, so we forget that so much of our history and so much of our culture comes from here.
Yeah.
And the reason that the St. Brendan and all those geezers and St. Gallen and Columbanus was the only other outpost of Christianity in the world at the time was Ireland. It was still a Christian nation.
Right.
So the Round Towers and the monks and Constantinople. These were the two poles of Christianity. And in the middle of Europe was all sorts of other stuff going on.
Yeah.
So there's fascinating similarities. But so I'm sitting there and I'm watching the seagulls at Galata Bridge and I'm looking at all sorts of things coming and going. And then you think, okay, well, what happened to this Byzantine Empire? The Byzantine Empire collapses in 1453, which has monumental consequences for the world, right? So the Ottomans are a crowd. They were based in a fella called Usman II.
Yeah.
And Usman's followers were called Usmenis, and that mutated into Ottomans.
Right.
And a fella called Mehmet II, he eventually took Constantinople and butchered all the Christian civilians and said, basically, I'll leave you alone if you convert to Islam. Lots of them didn't. But then what the Ottomans did after that, they said, look, maybe this mass conversion isn't the way to go. So what we will do is we will create an empire which says we are Islamic, but you can live here.
Give us a year on this.
So 1453, okay. Right? So between 1453 and 1550, just think about this, right? This is an amazing statistic. In 1550, Istanbul had a population of 600,000. The biggest city in Europe at the time was Paris, had a population of 300,000. So Istanbul was twice as big. And in the Ottoman Empire in 1550, the entire European population was 90 million. There were 28 million subjects of the Ottoman Empire. So that is how big it was. It was enormous, right? And they also said, they came up with this idea. They said, oh, hold on a second, we're Muslim, but you can live under our rule. You don't have to convert. Because they reckon the mass conversion, bad marketing, bad for branding. But you have to pay more taxes. So if you're Christian, if you're Jewish, if you're Zoroastrian, no matter what you are, you can live amongst us, but you have to pay a few more taxes.
Draw a geographical map for me. So outline the actual size of it.
So it went from Vienna to Dubai.
Right.
From Tunisia, Algeria, all the way to Iran.
Right.
It is an enormous empire. All of the Mediterranean, what they call the Mediterranean littoral. So basically the Mediterranean basin is entirely Ottoman, okay? Egypt, Algeria, Tunisia, all the way out that far.
All North Africa.
Greece, all the Balkans.
Yeah.
So Serbia, Bosnia, Albania, Greece, Bulgaria, all Ottomans. It's a phenomenal story, right? All the way up to Crimea and then south, the entire...
And how did they keep that huge area under control?
Well, they had these things called the Janissaries. So the Janissaries were their elite military and they were, in effect, child warriors. So what they did is they came, particularly in the Balkans, and they stole children and they turned those children. Yeah, I mean, it's a bizarre thing, right? So the Ottomans stole children. The firstborn was taken and was... taken back to Turkey, Turkey didn't exist at the time.
Yeah.
Taken back to Istanbul and turned into a warrior. So they had a very severe military structure, but they also had a very interesting bureaucracy. So what they basically said to everybody is, you can live under us.
Yeah.
You can be relatively tolerant. Just pay us taxes and we'll defend you. So whether you are Mamluks in Egypt or Jews in Palestine or Christians in Palestine or Christian Greeks, in Istanbul, we'll take you in. So for example, when the Jews got kicked out of Spain in 1492, the Sultan said, come and live with us and bring all your trade and bring all your knowledge and your knowledge of this, that, and the other and just live and you will pay a little bit more tax than everybody else, but you'll be left alone. So it was quite a cosmopolitan, quite a tolerant. It wasn't that everybody was treated equal, but everyone was treated reasonably fairly. These were the rules. And this became the world's biggest and most powerful empire. But for us in the West, what had a really consequential impact was the following, John. After 1453, when the Ottomans took over, 50 years later, a fellow called Columbus arrives in America. Now, what's the link between these? Columbus would never have arrived in America had it not been for the Ottomans. And the reason is the following. Oh. The Ottomans, and it's all back down to economics. The Ottomans said, Christian infidels, you cannot trade with the East. We will not allow you trade through our empire with China and India. And we were obsessed by trading with China and India. So it was...
Finding a new way.
It was to find a new way, exactly. Yes. And that precipitated the Portuguese to go down to Africa and around the Horn.
Okay.
And that precipitated the notion that the world might be round and we could go the other way to America. That's why Columbus thought they were Indians.
Yeah.
Because they were trying to get to India. But the reason they were trying to get to India was the Ottomans stopped them.
I didn't realize that was the driving force. Yeah. I knew they were looking for a new route to India and China. I just thought it was because they were looking for a shorter route.
No, they were stopped by the Ottomans. Right? So look at the Ottoman Empire like an electric shock to the world in 1543, economically and politically, right? So the shock was, you can't trade. So we had to figure out something else. But another shock was the following, John, that when the Muslims came in, they wanted to burn all the Christian books. And the Byzantine Empire had been this sort of cradle of Christian and pre-Christian and Greek, old ancient Greek, Plato, Aristotle, all those books, the originals were there. Mm. So they were brought to Italy by monks fleeing away from the Ottomans. And the very act of bringing those books increased or sparked an interest in ancient things, which turned into the Renaissance, because the Renaissance means the rebirth.
Yeah.
And it was the rebirth of ancient Greek philosophy. And the rebirth of, it's really fascinating. So intellectually, the electric shock, so trade-wise, the electric shock precipitated us moving to America and around Africa, which unfortunately was the beginning of European colonization, which again wouldn't have happened without the Turks. Think about it, right? Yeah. But the Renaissance also came from this because the interest in the ancient was precipitated by the fear that the Turks were trying to quench and destroy Greek ancient culture. So then that's where the Italians came up with Renaissance, the rebirth of culture.
That's fascinating.
And then, of course, the Renaissance leads to humanism. So the Renaissance changed the way in which people thought about the world. And you've got the likes of Galileo coming in and Michelangelo and Leonardo. And they're all saying, well, hold on a second. Let's push the boundaries of thought. Let's push the boundaries of science. So Copernicus, all these guys are coming on, all part of this cauldron of fascinating intellectual activity. Again, precipitated by the shock of the Ottomans.
Yeah.
This leads to humanism. Humanism is this idea that we don't just live on the world and we live, we pray and we go to heaven. Humanism is no. You live in the world and you try to leave your mark as a human.
Yeah.
So we get individual thought, humanism, the notion of science, progression, and all this is feeding into what becomes European civilization, all of which then becomes exported in the maritime routes because we needed to keep away from the Ottomans.
Right.
If it wasn't for these fellas, if you think of it, so they've been unbelievably consequential in our history.
So what was the downfall? I know it all fell apart during the First World War and stuff, but explain that process.
So the downfall happens at the same time as Irish nationalism and nationalism begins to become a potent force. And I've always been intrigued at how these ideas are kind of in the ether, right?
Yeah.
So it begins with the process. So the Ottoman Empire has these very, very loose association of all these different ethnicities. And the 19th century is the period of nationalism. So the first nationalism comes from the Greeks within the Ottoman Empire. And they say, we want our own nationalism. But the Greeks did something very clever. The Greeks said, we're not Greeks, we're Christians. So they invoked the rest of Christian Europe to come on their side, particularly the Russians. So the Russians in 1853 supported the Greeks and the Greeks got independence from the Ottomans.
Mm.
And then everyone looked at, if the Greeks can do it, who else can do it? And then suddenly you get the Bulgarians, the Balkan Wars. You remember these the Balkan Wars? And the Bulgarians, Serbs, Bosnians, they all start to agitate for independence. And so the Ottomans are beginning to fight these wars in the Balkans. And this is draining all their resources.
Yeah.
There's also, on the far side of Turkey, the Armenians are looking and the Georgians yes. are looking
yeah, yeah.
for independence. And then, of course, you've got the Brits meddling little over fires oil.
The
Brits,
all over the place.
Yeah. Little fires burning everywhere. The yeah. Brits find oil in Arabia at the late part of the 19th century. And they're like, ooh, we want a bit of this.
Yeah.
So the Brits, one of the greatest shysters in the world is Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
He was basically the paid agent of British oil interests, who was basically causing havoc amongst the poor old Turks, the Ottomans. So basically there's little fires everywhere.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Whack-a-mole.
Whack-a-mole, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's exactly what happened to them.
Yeah.
And again, they begin to atrophy and then they make the alliance with Germany. So they make an alliance with Germany because they're afraid of Russia.
Yeah.
So Russia, France and Britain surround Germany and the Turks say, well, hold on a second, our big enemy in the region is Russia and the Russians have just bailed out the Greeks.
Mm.
So we need to be in an alliance against them. So they join in the First World War with Germany.
Yeah.
And that leads to the confrontation with the Dublin Fusiliers.
Right.
And the Dublin Fusiliers go down because Churchill had this mad idea that he would capture the Dardanelles and he would then liberate Russia because the Russians would be blockaded by the Turks. And they sent the poor old paddies down there. And of course, Waltzing Matilda, because they sent the Anzacs.
Yes.
And the Waltzing Matilda is basically the beginning of a consciousness of Australians and New Zealanders as a distinct non-British race, effectively the Anzacs, who are down there fighting. So it's a fantastic story, but of course the guy who wins the Dardanelles, so basically the Allies were defeated in Gallipoli, and it was like shooting fish in a barrel. It was a terrible massacre. The guy who wins it on the Turkish side is a guy called Mustafa Kemal, and he is the man who creates modern Turkey. But his founding myth was based in Gallipoli as a great leader. And that's the link between the Dublin Fusiliers and the Munster Fusiliers and the foundation of the Turkish state, which we'll talk about in a minute.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Okay, Mac, we've covered beautifully the Ottoman Empire and
the Dublin Fusiliers, Waltzing Matilda.
Okay, what was that, 1,500 years we've just covered there?
Yeah, something economic like that. History. Go quickly. We're no room for slackers on this podcast, John. No room for slackers.
Okay, so talk to me about Ataturk then and the creation of modern Turkey.
Yeah,
right,
because
up
it's
until
a fascinating
now.
Story. I happen to believe that Ataturk is the most impressive leader of the 20th century.
Go
and
on.
I've been really fascinated by this guy for many, many, many years. And every time I go to Turkey, I can pick up these really good books, which are originally in Turkish, but translated into English about him. So very brief history. He's born in Thessalonica in Greece, right?
Yeah.
Salonica, as it was known then, which is part of what they would call the Western Empire.
Yeah. Okay. Another great Dubliner song, by the way. Salonica. Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. Yep.
We should play out with it. So Salonica is a multicultural, cosmopolitan, multi-ethnic, Turkish port in Greece, Ottoman port in Greece. Massive Jewish population, massive Christian population, massive Muslim population. So the three of them there. And he is born into a Muslim family. But he's very, very aware of what's happening all around him, which is basically the Ottomans are being beaten in Bosnia, in Sarajevo, in Serbia, in Bulgaria. They have a toehold in Albania, but basically the Western Empire is beginning to recede.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the anxiety and the neurosis of the Muslim people there, because they realize that all these little fires, as we said, are burning all over the place, right? And they are, although in the Ottoman Empire, very, very clearly on the border of the Ottoman Empire, and that border is beginning to atrophy. So that's his background. He becomes a soldier, ends up in the military, becomes a general, defeats the allies in Gallipoli, and he's the man. But all that he's part of was called the Young Turk Movement, which were secular military Turkish soldiers who could see that the Ottoman Empire was corrupt, was crumbling, was no match for the West. And they were very, very radical. They said, we have to change all this. But during the period 1915 all the way to 1920, 1922, it was basically the old Ottoman Empire fighting against various allies. So the Russians, the Brits, the French, they occupied, the Brits occupied Constantinople, they occupied Istanbul.
Yeah.
But Ataturk is infused by two ideas. One is nationalism and the other is science. And he called his movement Kemalism, but he called it nationalism sanctified by science, right? So he was an incredibly progressive person, right? He comes in, the new Turkish Republic rises from the ashes of the Ottoman Empire in 1923, a thing called the Treaty of Lausanne. And he comes in and he says, okay, our problem, and this is what all nationalist leaders do, is they crush diversity. And this is the stain of Ataturk, right? He's basically says, we have to create a Turkish identity. And that Turkish identity has to be Turkish, but we have to create a whole new way of looking at the world. And it was, you remember we had that those fellows, acceleration era?
Yes.
Ataturk was an accelerationist before acceleration. Elon Musk hasn't a patch on Ataturk, right? So think about what he did, right? He comes in, right? And he says, okay, we need to be European. We need to be scientific. We need to be look forward. We can't look backwards. So what he does, the very first thing he does, right? He changes time. So imagine this idea.
What do you mean he changes time?
He's obsessed by speed, by doing things quickly. What he says is the Ottoman Empire slowed down, atrophied, weakened. We have to accelerate and speed things up and move forward. First thing he does, 1923, up until then, all Turks were used to and used the Arabic calendar, which was set up at the time of Muhammad.
Yes.
They wake up on the 1st of January, 1924, the calendar's changed, right? It's gone forward 600 years.
Yes.
Right? Fuck. Okay, that's the first thing, change the calendar, right? Second thing is he changes the alphabet. He says, no more Arabic script, gone completely. He forces every publishing house, every newspaper, every school to actually force the people into the Western Latin script.
Quite a shock to the system.
Complete shock to the system. But that's the third thing he says is the caliphate, right? Yeah. Which was the center of Islamic culture. He says, it's gone. It was a bit like shooting the Pope, right? He actually comes in and basically says, you're gone. Yeah. We separate no more Islam. We separate church and state. Islamic law totally subservient now to civil Turkish law.
Right.
All Turkish women have the vote. All universal franchise, all across Turkey.
This incredibly is progressive.
Incredibly progressive. Polygamy is out.
Right.
So, you know, this idea that the Muslim man can have loads of wives. He's no, that's not it. And how did he actually introduce the end of polygamy? By no fault equal divorce in 1923.
Right.
So he said Turkish women can now go to court and divorce their men. And they can do it on a no fault basis, right? I don't like you anymore.
Right.
Okay.
It's not you, it's me.
It's not you. Yeah. I'm having a moment, right? Yeah. Okay. This is all done in a number of years, right? It's phenomenal change. Imagine you change the religion of the country. You shoot the Pope, in effect, by getting rid of the caliphate. You change the alphabet. You change the calendar. You change the voting rights. And remember we mentioned the Fez? He banned the Fez. The Fez is gone. He said...
No, that's a step too far.
He said, enough of the Fez, right? He said, the Fez represents the old, corrupted, Arabic, Muslim world.
Yeah.
We're looking west and we're wearing trilbies. So, you know, we've gone from Tommy Cooper and the Fez to, I don't know, Cary Grant or something like
that. Yeah.
And so he goes...
That's like banning the flat cap in Northern England.
Or in Ireland.
In Ireland.
Yeah, he bans everything, right?
Or the beret in
the
France.
The beret, yes, exactly. And what he does then is he's basically saying, we are a Western country. And he reorientates the entire country geopolitically to the West. So you can imagine the Ottoman Empire. Remember we said, it's North Africa, it's the Middle East... It's the Gulf, it's all those. He says, no, we've no more relations with these people.
Mm.
And he reorients, he just turns Turkey around. And of course, what he does is he begins the process of, in the Second World War, he says, look, we're not getting involved here. You know, we know what it's like. And he begins the process of becoming an independent country. And this he did, he died in 1938. He died quite young.
Yeah.
He did all this in about a 10-year period and completely changed the DNA of Turkey.
But he must have had a willing population.
Well, he had a traumatized population. So he had a population that just lost their empire.
Right.
And he said, look, the reason we lost the empire was our fault, that we became lazy and indigent and we were living off past glories.
Mm.
He forged the Turkish identity. There was no Turkish identity. So like the Ottoman Empire, the Turks were a minority. Right? They weren't the majority.
I suppose because it was so huge.
It was so huge.
And for so long that it
and of course,
dilutes.
What he saw, like he saw the Brits and the French gobble up the empire. So
yeah.
Israel, Palestine, was before Israel. So Palestine, Syria, Iraq, the Gulf states, you know, Saudi Arabia. These were all created by the Brits and the French. And he saw that and he said, look what these guys are doing, right? They are the imperialists. So he also spun it very well. He said, we are anti-imperialist.
Mm.
We are a new nation. We are a Turkish nation. We have this new identity. And basically, they are the imperialists.
Okay, but economically, what did he do? How did he reinvigorate the economy of Turkey?
First of all, through the education system. So basically, Turkey has always been a big, big player, right?
Yeah.
So it's a big, big player. But rapid industrialization. Rapid industrialization.
Okay.
He tried to do what all, you know, basically developing country leaders do. They tried to create big national projects. So imagine in Ireland, right? What defined Ireland, right, was the hydroelectric Ardna Cruachan station, which generated electricity. And this was a really important thing for the Irish state to do. So it basically said, we can do things that the other colonizers couldn't do.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, in contrast to De Valera doubled down on Catholicism, right?
Yeah.
Our friend Ataturk doubled down on atheism and secularism. So it was a totally different, and he was very unusual in that regard.
Yeah.
He also managed to spin the idea that basically Turks were oppressed by the Ottomans and that they were part of a colonial project where they were the victims, not the oppressors.
Okay.
Which is very clever marketing, right? Mm. And the Turkish economy grew dramatically after him. He died in the late 30s. And then, of course, you've got Kemalism as the ideology.
Yeah, he set it all in train, yeah.
And so you have a series of sort of military governments. Then you have democratic governments. Now, in fairness, it was a one-party state.
Yes.
It wasn't, there was no...
Yeah, that always helps.
Yeah, it does help, yeah. If we have a gig job, we'll have a one-party state, you know. But he created Turkey.
So he attracted lots of inward investment? Or where did that money come from?
No, mainly the most of the capital was within Turkey at the time,
okay, right?
Because it was a very rich place, you know?
Yeah.
It was a very, very rich place. But it, of course, stagnated in the 1950s and 1960s and then grew very, very rapidly in the 70s and the 80s.
Okay, but here's the thing that, I mean, we were talking on Tuesday about Erdogan and him conducting this 20-year experiment.
Yes.
Where he essentially is going against everything that Ataturk...
Yeah.
And the weird thing about Ataturk is, the one thing I know about him, he is seen as the founding father and he's like George Washington in the
States.
You're
absolutely right.
So he was so revered. How come Erdogan could
against... This is the fascinating thing. And we'll probably conclude here because it brings us up to the present leadership. So Erdogan is a product of secular Turkey. He's born in Ataturk's Turkey.
Yeah.
He's raised in Ataturk's Turkey. He understands it. What he has been trying to do over the last 20 years is completely flip the Turkey that Ataturk created on its head by bringing Islam back into the not in the mainstream, it's always been an Islamic country, but bringing Islam into government. So he's tried to stop the separation of church and state. He's tried to Islamicize the schools. He's also tried to radicalize, or been happy that the country people are radicalized and they're voting for him. Yeah. So it's this weird, it's a combination of nationalism and Islam. And that has been a very, very potent experiment. And interestingly as well, of course, the West has helped, because the West has been looking for some time for a model of Islam. So after the Iranian Revolution, everything changes in the West. So the Iranian Revolution in 1979 profoundly changes Western thinking about Muslim countries. And the idea is, can you have this third way Muslim country that has got one foot in the West, in NATO, but yet is very, very much Muslim? Or is it basically an all or nothing gig? Is it either you're Iranian and there are mullahs taking over and it's an Islamic republic, or you have a secular Ba'athist republic like Saddam Hussein had, or like, for example, Nasser had in Egypt in the 1950s and 60s. Yeah. Interestingly, there were two models vying for that. One was Algeria and one was Turkey. So Algeria had a jihadist war in the 1990s, which has been largely forgotten about, but was unbelievably brutally put down by the Algerian military, right? Yeah. And it was mass, kind of ISIS-style massacres. And it was kind of reported, but it wasn't really. And America thought, okay, that's what happens when Islam goes against military governments. You get massacres. And the Americans were thinking, is there an example of a country that can kind of be Islamic and capitalist, be Western and Eastern, you know, all at the one time? And that's why they supported Erdogan, because he seemed to, at the beginning, a bit like Putin was seen at the beginning as a reformer.
Yeah.
Erdogan was seen at the beginning as a reformer. So the West created Erdogan. Like,
right,
you know,
yeah.
And very much embrace this idea, because we think, okay, a muscular Turkey in the region, he's part of our gang. Yeah, he's a little bit Islamic, but you know what? This could be the future. And all the while, that squeezed the secular people in and around, particularly Istanbul. So, for example, all the women's legislation, all women's rights, all equality, all of that was beginning to be suppressed. And as I said, it was a 20-year experiment. And in the last couple of months, that experiment is beginning to atrophy. And this then is the next phase of Turkey's history, John, or Turkey's future, is basically a war between the Erdogan Turkish view and the Ataturk Turkish view. And whoever wins that battle will win the future of Turkey. And that's what's really up for grabs now, which is why, John, we're doing this podcast, because it is a country on the tip of changing. And the way Turkey goes, maybe it's the way the rest of the Middle East goes. So we watch it for a while.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.